Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
The stuff you wear is inappropriate for what you're planning on doing.
You don't know anything about me. I'm ready.
You're not. So none of the stuff that you're thinking means anything anyway.
Never kissed anyone before.
Hello and welcome to the last episode of Still Watching about the HBO series We Are Who We Are. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you're just joining us on Still Watching, what we do every week is Richard and I pick a show that we're currently sort of obsessing over, watching very closely. We break down the latest episode and we go from there. So we are closing the chapter on We Are Who We Are. And we have already opened our next chapter, which is The Undoing, also on HBO. So those podcasts already exist in your feed. We are two episodes into The Undoing as you are listening to this recording. But we are here to wrap up this other series that I found, like, that I loved way more than I thought I was going to. So I'm actually kind of sad to say goodbye to this series. Richard, how are you feeling about the end of this era?
Yeah, sad. I mean, I think, you know, we've talked about this before, but, you know, given the time frame of the series and the time frame we're in right now in real life, right before an election, which, as you're listening to this, will be tomorrow, you feel both kind of like all of the hope that these two kids run into the world with at the very end, but also a kind of bittersweet nostalgia in a strange way, even though things had just gotten worse than they already were. So yeah, it's a heady mix of things, but I think that we can talk about, but like, I think that actually really beautifully captures what it feels like at times to be that age.
So we are going to be talking about this final episode, which is, it's funny, like looking at the emails that we got from our listeners, and you can always email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Everyone seemed to have like a different expectation of what this finale would be. I think a lot of people thought we were going to wrap up with a more comprehensive check-in with a lot of characters. But we barely see anyone outside of Frasier and Harper in this final episode, which maybe is sort of, maybe we should have seen that coming. I don't know. But we got a lot of emails about Maggie. I'm sorry to say to people that like we will not be checking in with Maggie in this episode, but let's talk about those emails a little bit before we get into this Maggie-less episode. We're going to start with this email from Fernanda, who is from Brazil, and so was sort of excited to see some Brazilian representation in the form of Maggie, and said, "I've been fascinated by the juxtaposition of how the two families interact with their mother's cultures. In episode 3, Jenny tells Maggie that she has to cook American food, and just a couple of scenes earlier, Sarah was offering Harper some farofa, a Brazilian dish. In the same episode, we see a corny mug with Brazilian flag on Fraser's desk, later Brazilian music by legendary composer Tom Jobim, I think is how you pronounce that name, is playing when Sarah walks Harper out, and it continues in the background when Sarah and Fraser fight. In comparison to the Poitras family, they seem very progressive, for lack of a better word. I find it interesting that Sarah is always highlighting that openness, re-saying she learned Portuguese. To me, it's similar to her approaching Harper about being a male soldier, basically affirming to herself that she is different than the men around her. She's intellectually and spiritually advanced. For all of Sarah's display, there's no indication that Fraser carries any influence of Brazilian culture." And then Fernanda says, "I imagine the kids have also had to downplay any foreign influences because in strange lands they have always had to define themselves by their Americanness. In contrast, we saw Harper speaking Yoruba in the pilot and obviously Danny's identity crisis. Plus, Maggie's not a Brazilian name. At best, it's an Americanized name. Sarah embodies a kind of white liberal who loves to boast about the progressiveness, but whose acceptance only works insofar as they remain the intellectual better and the one in charge. Sarah saying Maggie can never know what it's like to have her own son say I hate you while Brazilian music plays in the background feels like a great way to make this point, but again, I might be overthinking. I hope I didn't bore you with my essay. Thank you both for the podcast. Looking forward to the last two discussions. So, yeah. So what do you think of this, I do think it's interesting that there is like this otherness, nationally speaking, this otherness identity within both of these families, specifically in these caring sort of caretaker mom roles. What do you think, Richard?
Well, I think first of all, I don't think that there is any way to read too much into the show. I think it's deliberately, you know, vague, you know, in some of its portraiture of these characters. So I think it's a show that is ripe for interpretation, and knowing what I do about Guadagnino's engagement with, you know, criticism and writing about his work, I think he would welcome that. So don't feel bad about that. But and if there was reading too much into this show, what are we doing for the past seven episodes? But you know, I think that we talked about this early in the run of the season about this concept of third culture kids, kids who are, I guess, nationally from someplace but grew up elsewhere and have maybe four parents who are of differing nationalities, and what that means for one's sense of identity, especially on a military base where there is this like very aggressive form of nationalism, you know, sort of everywhere you look. But I think of many things, this show is about these two kids learning both about the absolutes of the world and the complete opposite. And their parents represent those things in various ways too. You know, certain convictions about politics that maybe Harper's father has, or lack of conviction about what a marriage should be that, that Fraser's parents have. And that goes all the way to nationality and stuff. So I think that parental portraiture has really been interesting on the show, but I do think that the series ended where it needed to, because it was about these kids and their parents will continue on probably mostly in the same way.
Right.
And the kids though are still, you know, ever evolving.
I love that. And I do think it's interesting in this episode when the kids get picked up, you know, by these strangers and given a ride to the concert, and they're asked if they're Americans, and they're like, yeah, we're Americans. And it's like, yeah, they are Americans. Like, you know, in theory, but
they qualify it though. They're like, but we live on a military, but, you know, because they don't want to be just be like, they don't want to be tourists, you know, like, but we live in Italy, you know?
Yeah. And this idea, I didn't know this, but, you know, Harper says like, we can only live there like max 3 years. And oftentimes it's less than that. Yeah. I didn't know that 3 years was sort of like the max on that. So, all right, more Maggie content. I'm like fascinated by how many Maggie emails we got, honestly. So shout out to Elisa Braga for doing a great job with this character. Okay.
The hot queer woman engendered a lot of responses.
Okay, fair enough. All right, so Veronica wrote in, my favorite detail about the breakup scene between Maggie and Jenny is when Jenny tells Maggie, you would understand if you had children of your own, which is something we've also heard Sarah say to Maggie in an earlier episode. The difference is that Jenny immediately apologizes and recognizes this as a hurtful thing to say, brought on by her own grief, while, if I remember correctly, Sarah says this very casually and completely oblivious of the hurt it causes Maggie. Maggie receives so much more respect and compassion from Jenny than from Sarah. I think you're both absolutely right that the events of the last episode have led the two families to circle the wagon and stand firmly with their own family unit, despite how they've become intertwined. I envision this having a dire effect on Fraser and Harper in the last episode, but I also find it to be quite tragic for Maggie. Fitting with the overall theme of loss in this episode, including a literal electoral loss, Maggie's loss of Jenny seems to harden her into a defensive, us-versus-them survival mode, which can also be said of the country at this time. Thank you so much for this podcast, from Veronica. And I'm just going to follow Veronica's email really quickly with this other one, because I just think we can talk about them together. This one comes from Caroline. And she says, for this penultimate episode, y'all mentioned the idea the show is telling us we should have been paying attention. And I definitely felt that too. Almost like we're being chided for getting caught up in the youthful romances and forgetting that the whole story is taking place against the backdrop of war. I think we see it most transparently in the scene between Jenny and Maggie, with Jenny's comments that they should have been watching the kids. I took it to mean that she was starting to awaken to her complicity / culpability in the military-industrial complex, though maybe the industrial part of that moniker is irrelevant here, where we're talking about more about the human cost than the economic. Earlier in the episode, the kids in the grief counseling session seem to be grappling with this weight too, but without the power and agency of the adults on the base who chose to become involved with the military. For those kids and the military spouses to an extent, they might be more committed to their own families than to any notion of self-sacrifice, but the ripple effect of grief does not discriminate. Although I've been enjoying the show on an aesthetic level every week, Craig's death and the aftermath was one of the very first moments that really moved me on an emotional level, other being Harper crying out for her dad's love and support, even as he was pushing them away post-haircut. But getting back to Maggie, it has driven me nuts that characters keep implying that she doesn't know what it's like to have a child. It's such an unfair accusation. We know that she's been in Sarah's life since before Frasier was even born. So she's raised him just as much as Sarah has, perhaps more so since we see that she's the one Frasier turns to in his toughest moments. So if I have any one specific hope for the finale, is that someone, hopefully Frasier, finally acknowledges the impact she's had on his life. Looking forward to hearing y'all's thoughts on the finale, Caroline. So Caroline did not get her wish. Maggie is even mentioned in this finale. But like, this idea of like, it does strike me as wild every time someone implies that like Maggie is not a mother or doesn't know what it's like to be a mother. It's completely wild to me. I can't imagine saying that to someone who has even spent any time raising a child. Do you have any thoughts on this, Richard?
Well, there's an interesting scene in this episode where Frasier, you know, confesses the thing about Mark, but also before that is talking about his mother and how she's, you know, kind of always co-opts some, you know, someone he likes or whatever, and then says, you know, I've only met my grandfather like 3 times, and then he was just like her. And, you know, so this is there is a legacy of this within this family, and I think we see some of that bluntness, that you know, uncharitable way of talking to people in Frasier, you know. I think that is just yet another thing that these kids, you know, are just trying to figure out who they are in the context of so many things: their own bodies, their communities, their families, their countries, whatever that means. I think it's important that we got to know the intricacies of these two parental units. Ultimately the story had to move past that and focus again on our two leads.
Well, especially since, you know, this episode and the series as a whole, if we're to take what this final episode is interested in as sort of a comment on what the whole thing has been about, is about exactly what the title says, which is we are who we are. We're trying to figure out who we are. We are young. Our identities perhaps defy gender and sexual orientation, like, definitions, and we're figuring it out. And the way in which we have opportunities to be like our parents and the way in which we have opportunities to be not like our parents, and which parent are we going to be like? So I actually think Maggie is in this episode. I'll get to it in the end, but I do think Maggie's in this episode in kind of a surprising way, despite not appearing. All right, just 2 more emails. This first one's about Sarah. Last mom email, I will say. all right. I just wanted to comment on Sarah's public changing. I thought this was just another and more extreme example of her absolute lack of boundaries, like her eating other people's food, drinking their drinks, etc. She is exerting her power and dominance in all these moves. However, in her boundary-challenged relationship with Frasier, the power dynamic is often flipped, with Frasier generally being more aggressive, after her provoking him, of course. Possibly she feels the need to exert her power and authority over others more, since she feels out of control in her relationship with her son. Or maybe she just thinks that is how she demonstrates authority and command with her troops. Also, I know you both were obviously too professional to bring this up, but I could not help but be incredibly distracted by that scene, by her lack of bra, that she ended up putting on her dress clothes that she will be in all day, doing very important public things all day, being up close and personal with grieving people all day without a bra, not to like control people's bodies, but that doesn't sound very comfortable or professional from Joy. So yeah, this, you know, Joy's email made me think about Frasier's behavior for a lot of this episode in this finale episode, where I'm frustrated that Frasier abandons Harper at this concert. But if we think about when Frasier says awful blunt things, which he does mostly to his mom, but occasionally to Harper, or when he behaves selfishly, which he mostly hasn't. He's been very, like, clingy to Harper. So this like, abandoning her, or abandoning them, that feels like a Sarah move to me. He's, like, following what he's interested in the moment without thinking about this person that he's, like, left behind at this concert. I got really anxious because, like, I feel like I've been Harper in a lot of situations. And I was like, oh my God, how dare you leave them alone? I don't know. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think Harper had their own thing to do at that concert. I think they were both, this kid's about to move to Japan, probably.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of stuff kind of... none of this night is representing any sort of permanency. And so I thought that what was so bittersweet and kind of perfect about the way that the two kids parted and then came back together during this kind of magical night was that, like, that's going to have to happen. And it does happen, not just because someone moves to Japan, but it just happens as you get older. And as, especially these two people who are really figuring themselves out and trying to find community and companionship romantically. Like, and I think I think that there was, on Harper's case, on their side of things, like, not so much an anger at Frasier, but a kind of, like, weary understanding and then they did the same thing to Frasier. Like, Frasier got abandoned at the concert, you know? So, like, it just felt very true to, in a distillated way, like, or distilled way, of a longer story of friends who are, you know, people who are friends when they're young, and what inevitably, unless they, like, stay together the rest of their lives, eventually has to happen.
I mean, it's true that Harper has their own journey at the concert, but it's a journey that it's not their first choice of a journey at that concert, it would be my interpretation. Like, I feel like Harper felt abandoned starting in the car. Like, this is supposed to be, like, this thing that they were going to do together, right? And you get this sequence on the train where they're, like, forehead to forehead listening to this song that they've practiced, and they're going to sing it together when it comes up at the concert. And this was the plan. And you're right, you know, like, yes, youthful plans of togetherness often go awry. Obviously, yes, you're completely right about, like, friendships changing and stuff like that. But this idea that, like, Frasier meets this boy in the car who speaks his language about fashion, and immediately Harper is left out of it, and walks into the room without once turning back to see if Harper is right behind him, and then later texts, "Where did you end up?" Which is just like, oh, that, I don't know, like, maybe I'm just over-identifying or laying onto Harper how I would feel. But I felt like Harper was, like, actually very angry. And the text outside where Harper's like, I gotta go to the train station, I gotta go, and just left, is like an anger at being, I thought, abandoned. And like, it's healed in the end, because in the end, you know, Frasier could have seen the most beautiful thing in the world, I suppose, with this stranger that he met. But he ran for 45 minutes straight to get to the train station in order to make sure that he spends that moment with Harper instead. And Harper obviously feels very valued in that moment. So, like, I feel like Frasier reorients his priorities at the end of the episode, but loses focus of what should matter most to him for most of for that center section of the episode. That's my reading of it. I guess.
Yeah, I mean, sure. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, he's texting Harper when the song's playing, like, where are you, looking for them. And Harper's backstage and just took a selfie with the guy, yeah. You know. So, you know, I see it as a bit more of an equitable split. But yes, I do think that Fraser realizes, like, this night was about the two of us, and that other adventure can wait. That will come.
All right, last email, and then we will get back to discussion of this episode itself. This one comes from Michael, who says, just thought I'd point out that after Fraser runs out of a potentially sexual encounter with Jonathan and his girlfriend and arrives home and gets wasted, his moms wake him up and he asks why his moms never tell him anything about his dad. Throughout the series, I assumed that Fraser was romantically interested in Jonathan, and maybe he was, but him asking about his father made me think his interest in Jonathan was more about seeking out a father figure than a lover. This idea was reinforced for me by the way Fraser didn't try to kiss Jonathan, but just wanted to be held by him. Also, just wanted to note that Luca loves for his young male protagonist, Elio from Call Me By Your Name, and Fraser to leave freezers open for women to have to close them. Maggie, in this case, big fan of the pod. I also get stressed out, by the way, when, like, freezer and refrigerator doors are left open on TV shows. Yeah, so what do you make of this question around what Fraser is looking for from Jonathan?
I mean, I have no doubt that that's part of it. You know, I think it's both of those things. And I think that's, I mean, time-old, you know, age-old tradition of people dating someone who they see a parent in, you know, to some extent.
Yeah.
I also think in some senses the, like, very drunk, like, you never tell me about my dad is sincere. I think part of it also was not a put on, but an immediate plea for sympathy.
Yeah.
You know, like, I got shit faced and shouldn't have done that. And I'm now passed out on the floor and I was gone most of the night. So, oh, well, how can I get immediate sympathy? Oh, my dad, you know,
yeah.
Like, I think it was genuine, but also a tactic.
That makes sense to me. What it comes down to, and it's so interesting because I was remembering at the beginning of the series when you and I were talking about what we want for Harper and Fraser, and we were like, do we want them to be romantically entangled, or do we want them to be just supportive pals through their journey of identity? And you and I both, like, landed on supportive pals, but at the same time, I'm not mad about where this episode ends at all. And I think it's because in these final sort of swirling moments of last episode and this episode, we get both, this is where I think it's very equitable. We get both Fraser and Harper approached by two different people. There's Jonathan and Jonathan's plus one last week. There's this boy in this episode. And then for Harper, there's Brittany and there's the bartender. And it's just sort of like, is it this? No, it's none of that. It's this. It's mm-hmm. It's our connection. Harper and Fraser, like, watching Harper kiss, I think, like, three people, and sort of have zero reaction in this series, or four, I suppose, and have, like, pretty much zero reaction in this series, and then their smile when Fraser kisses them. I'm not saying that these kids are going to, like, happily ever after their OTP, they're going to get married or anything like that. As you say, I think, you know, they're about to be separated. This is the end of something. But that smile was just sort of the world to me, where Harper's like, no, it's this. This is what I want. And this is what, you know, fills me with that, like, youthful, exuberant, happy feeling. That was my journey in this episode. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that what that moment is, they're coming together, is them doing exactly what you said, is having, perhaps for both of them, a first experience where you're like, okay, now I know what it feels like when it's right. And now I can take this throughout, hopefully, more of my life.
Yeah.
You know, I think so many people have rocky starts with romance in their teen years. And it takes them a long time to figure out what the right thing is. I may or may not be speaking from personal experience. And I think that the little gift that this show gives them at the end, even though so much of their lives is, you know, uncertain, is saying, okay, well, as you, you know, both spin off into the world in different directions, you know this thing. And the next person you meet in whatever form you're in and where you are, like, you're going to remember what it could feel like and should feel like,
yeah.
maybe.
Yeah.
I don't think they're going to have any sort of long distance romance or anything. I think this night is kind of goodbye.
Yeah.
And that kiss is goodbye, or the several kisses. And I think they know that. But who really cares? They really like each other. They love each other. And it doesn't matter what their gender is or what their supposed orientation is. It's just about, like, that pure connection. And I think in that way, like, the end of the show is so, I mean, I got teary. I mean, it's so hopeful.
Same, yeah.
Even as these kids are tearing off into the, like, literally the dawn of a completely challenging and changed world.
I was doing that thing that I think is inevitable that one does at the end of something like this. Like, I did it a little bit with Normal People, but I think I decided at the end of Normal People that I would prefer to not know what happens to those two characters and what, you know, people seem really obsessed with what happens to the set of young lovers at the end of Normal People. And I'm like, I kind of like not knowing. But for this, I couldn't help but think sort of like, okay, what does this mean? And I agree with you. I don't see this as the beginning of a long distance romance between Italy and Okinawa or anything like that. But I did sort of have a vision of, like, I think they'll see each other again, you know, maybe several times. And anytime they see each other, it will just be like no time has passed, that they have, that this connection that they're forging here over the course of the series and over the course of this night, means that, you know, that there are some people in your life where when you see them, it's just immediately, like, comfortable and, you know, it should be rare, but that connection is a real thing. And I was just, like, sort of imagining, like, Fraser visiting Harper, Harper visiting Fraser, and them just immediately, like, you know, smiling and hugging and stuff like that. And it doesn't mean that they're, like, together romantically. It just means I see you, you see me, and that's really important to me, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think, like, right before I left for college, a really close girlfriend of mine who was straight hooked up, like, lightly, nothing serious.
Yeah.
And it was, like, so weird. And the next morning I was like, why, how the hell did that happen? And we had been so close that summer, and we were saying goodbye to our teenage life and going away to school. And I mean, she was going to my same college, but, like, we weren't going to see each other much. and you know, it didn't feel at all like some kind of violation of the identity I was already out. Like, it didn't feel like a violation of that at all. It just felt like, well, here's this other thing that happened, you know? And I think that the fluidity and the questioning that this show has, I think, pretty carefully and intelligently dealt with throughout the season, is given such a nice bit of proof in a way, those last scenes. You know, it's just like, yeah, it can function. It really sometimes is just about the person, you know, that kind of trite thing that people say, I don't see gender, I don't, whatever, it's just about the person. And you sometimes roll your eyes at that, because desire seems to be so much more of, like, a gut kind of fixed thing.
Yeah.
But in this case, it's like, no, it's just that these two people in this, you know, in this morning are right for each other.
Can I tell you a story, since you very kindly just shared a personal story? Can I tell you a story that I haven't thought about in, like, a really long time?
Please.
Which is that I went to a Rufus Wainwright concert with a guy friend of mine who I only knew to have dated guys and slept with guys and who, like, occasionally wore makeup and stuff like that. And I absolutely, 1,000% in like the deepest marrow of my bones, knew that that was just, like, a friend night at a concert. And then he, like, initiated a hookup with me at the end of the night. And I was so confused, mm-hmm. and not unhappy about it, but I was just sort of like, this is not, I don't, and like, I haven't thought about that in a long time, but that idea of, like, that's sort of like what this whole series is trying to be, is just sort of like, you know, unlock from those more rigid definitions or more rigid expectations of what something might be, and leave yourself open to connection where you find it, because connection is rare. And if you find it, you find it, sort of thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think when thinking about that in the broader kind of political context of the show, you know, I love that line in What the Constitution Means to Me, which is on Amazon. People can watch it now.
Yes.
Where Heidi Schreck says, you know, about a younger generation, she's like, I like to think that they're shining a light backwards, you know, behind them, so, you know, we can follow them into the light or whatever. I'm paraphrasing. It's a much more elegant line when she says it. But I think this kind of final image of these kids running into the new day,
yeah,
is it made me think about like all the horrid bullshit politically that is going to plague the world for the next 4 years and beyond, and had before, but like in a more concentrated form from 2016 on, and how they're just kind of, they're maneuvering it, they're cutting through it, they're finding sneaky little workarounds, they're transgressing in whatever way they can. And I think the show, you know, hopes that the audience in an emotional, intellectual sense follows them. But I like that the camera doesn't, that the show just lets them go off, and hopefully we can trust that they, with many other, you know, interesting young people, are like forging a path ahead for us.
Yeah.
And as much as that is going to raise so many questions about like, I thought you liked boys, or, you know, whatever the fuck, they're going to be thinking and engaging and you know, living lives under the crush of something that can feel really impossible a lot of the time.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
I love that. I'm getting kind of emotional. I really loved this series. I love this series so much. And I'm really glad that we watched it and we discussed it. I want to loop back to sort of earlier in the episode and talk about a few scenes or moments and see how we feel about them. One moment would be when Frasier is helping Harper sort of apply this beard again to their face. And Harper asks, like, do you like me like this, like a man? And Frasier mm-hmm. says, I don't know, are you still you? And that on one level that can be read as a one of those rude things that Frasier says that's like a little Sarah-esque in its insensitivity. But on the other hand, I do have some questions about you know, later Harper very like emphatically washes his beard off their face, so that maybe this particular, I don't want to say performance of gender, but expression of gender, I suppose, is maybe not what they want. I don't know, what do you think of that?
At least in that form, at that age,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like who
right.
knows? I think that, like, you know, initially with the scene where Harper washed their face and then they get together, and I was like, is this show saying that they're just cis straight people?
No,
you know, like,
yeah.
Like, and obviously it's not.
Right.
I think that it's what it's doing, which is pretty gracious of the show. And I think I wish, you know, that I was better at this in my own writing and my own thinking about the world. But like, the show is allowing them just like the time, you know, it's like you can experiment and you can figure it out, and you don't, it doesn't have to be fixed. It can, and you can reject the beard at this age, and you can embrace it when, however many years later, months later, days later, tomorrow, who cares? Like, it's just about, you know, it's the present tense of the title of the show,
yeah,
and the subtitle. I think for me, it, that moment, the beard moment, was more reminiscent of, you know, certain things. God, I'm trying to think of a specific example, like maybe an episode of the new Babysitter's Club show on Netflix, but those moments when kids just are like, you know what, like, let's just be kids. Like, let's let the other stuff, you know, that'll come when that can wait, you know, let's just be in the present tense, and worry about the other things later. I don't think that that means that Harper's sense of maybe discomfort in their own body has gone away or anything. Right. It's just like, you know, I don't want to, you know, I think it reflects back to the scene earlier when they're talking about Mark being, doesn't exist. And then Harper's like, well, yeah. You know, Craig doesn't exist. We don't exist. And it's like, yeah, you may, you don't in some sense yet exist. You know, you get to, I mean, there's so much time to figure that out, hopefully. And, there's no need to, you know, put on something so you can feel seen.
Yeah, it's that is another scene that I want to talk about. And I really do. I think there's something really beautiful and a little obviously disturbing, because, you know, for Harper to say sort of joyously, Craig doesn't exist, about a friend who has just died, is sort of like, it's bright and dark at the same time. But this idea of like, basically this episode could be slotted into the genre of One Crazy Night, right? Which is a genre of film that we see, you know, and this sort of like liminal space where you exist, where you, you know, or even like Midsummer Night's Dream, right? Like you're off on an adventure. This isn't real life. And you can learn real things about yourself, but, you know, running off to, I think it's Bologna where they go or something like that, you know, running off to a concert is an escape, is being in a forest somewhere, is not real existence, even though you can, you know, have very real emotions and real transformations about it. And so I like this idea of this episode being like this. I mean, as much as I did want, you know, more closure on maybe some of our other characters, then I can look back at last week's episode and say, like, okay, that was the closure. The closure mm-hmm. was Sarah and Maggie being like, we are in lockstep and we are us versus them. That was the end of their story, for as far as we're concerned. And instead we're in this like in between space, this goodbye, this long goodbye between these characters. I think it's really beautiful. The other moment that I, the last moment that I really want to, well, actually two more, second to last moment I want to talk about is this backstage moment with this bartender that Harper meets. The bartender, you know, it sort of just reinforces exactly what you're talking about, Richard, in terms of this bartender says, like, you're transgender, no, you're F to M. And Harper says, I think so. And the bartender says, sei bello, using a masculine, like, adjective to describe Harper, and then kisses Harper. And Harper, once again, I don't think this show is saying Harper is definitely not transgender. I just think any attempts to box these children right now is something that they're rejecting. And even if that maybe is the identity that Harper eventually lands on, it's not a box they feel comfortable in right now. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think also earlier when the bartender takes Harper backstage and says hi to the musicians, is like, this is a friend of mine. He's a big fan. And I think that's the first time we've heard that. Right.
Frasier says he to refer to Harper in the car.
Okay.
But I do think, okay, this episode,
I missed that.
No, yeah. No, but I do think this episode is the first time. So, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think that, like, I think, you know, Frasier had his two grown up for me experience last week.
Yeah.
And I think in some senses this was Harper's. You know, it was not as fraught by any means. We don't know how old that bartender was, but, you know, but like it was still that kind of a moment. And then, you know, Frasier ran away at the end of that one and Harper ran away at the end of this one.
Yeah.
And they eventually found each other. You know, I think, again, it's just that, like, I am ready for some things and I'm certainly ready to explore and think about it and research and try things out. But I'm not quite ready to jump in the deep end of the pool yet, you know, and that's OK.
And then I really liked this boy that Frasier meets, who has a girlfriend but still kisses Frasier, has never kissed a boy before. And then Frasier's like, "Do you like it?" He's like, "Oh, I don't think so." And it's just like very like casual and nice and friendly and sweet. But, you know, not where Frasier should be on Harper's last night, you know what I mean? But it's still like a very nice interaction. But what do you make of this moment when Frasier leaves the boy to go find Harper? Sorry, I keep saying the boy because I don't know the kid's name. To find Harper and that boy, this Italian kid, literally blips out of existence. I don't know if you caught that. It's a very weird, like, magic wand moment where the frame is on the boy left alone and then he just sort of like boops and there's a sound effect too out of existence, like he doesn't matter. I don't know, do you have any thoughts on that? Because there's some unusual things that start the episode, like I thought my screener was like flipping out when like the beginning of the episode, like Harper's getting the pizza and it's a lot of like weird freeze frame and slow-mo and stuff like that. So, you know, like the show has been experimenting with sort of like odd things, the camera flips at one point in this episode, etc. But that sort of like boop boop, like gone moment, I thought was really interesting for that kid.
Yeah, I think that kid, I mean, not to get like mystical about it, it's like, did that kid exist?
Right.
Like were they really in a car with, did they just happen to at a random gas station in the middle of the night run into, you know, fans of this musician, and then there was this boy that Frasier could kiss, and they, you know, like it, there was a sense of like, I think for me what the show was saying with that was like, you know, this is going to keep happening. Like if you're lucky and you put yourself out there, you're going to meet people, you know, you know, that's the thing that like, I think a lot of queer kids, if they, depending on when they come out or starting to realize things about themselves, is like, if there is an encouraging voice in their lives, it might be saying something like, just wait, you know, or like try to find like-minded people, or, you know, like there's always that sense of promise, I guess. And like, you know, after the Jonathan disaster, like, oh, here's this other sweet boy who like is at least interested in kissing Frasier and showing him his beloved city of Bologna, like a little tour guide.
Yeah.
You know, I think there was also maybe something about Bologna being like the kind of bookish, very cultured academic city of Italy, you know, and that's where this kind of final thing took place. I think there was something being said there. I don't know what exactly about, like, you know, was it then like almost experiencing like university life in one night? I don't know. But
I like the
presence of that funny kid who would definitely be on an Italian Disney Channel show.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, like, I was thinking about, you know, we brought up Romeo and Juliet earlier in the season when we were talking about Craig's wedding, right? And sort of the, like, specifically Baz Luhrmann sort of Romeo and Juliet evocation in that episode. And then when this season ends with, like, Harper and Frasier, you know, lovingly kissing each other, I'm like, are they Romeo and Juliet? You know, like they're of warring families, like sort of thing. Like, I think that's kind of interesting. This idea that this might be a sort of like Midsummer Night's Dream. They're with the wrong people in the forest for a while until they find the right people kind of thing. I just like that those possible illusions, whether or not they're there, exist in the show. The show is just so fun to watch and think about. So I'm really glad we watched it. All right, the last thing I want to talk about is something that our listeners, I think, tried to warn us over and over and over again about, which is like how important the music of Blood Orange and Dev Hynes would be for the show. And the fact that we spend this last episode essentially at a Dev Hynes concert, that Dev Hynes is in this episode, that we watch like full musical numbers in this episode. There's a part of me, I like the setting of this episode. There's a part of me that feels a little frustrated because while we're watching like a full musical number, and this is very off character for me because usually I'm pro musical numbers, I'm like, I want to spend time with my characters.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I want to be at this concert. Like, why do you think the show does this in the end?
You know, they're getting lost in like the din of their own passions. You know, they're like they've gone to the nexus of their of their shared, you know, love, and it's this bright, loud thing, and they lose each other within it. You know, I think that makes some sense to me. I can think about like getting swept up in doing theater where the person I auditioned for a play with, the friend I kind of entered this adventure with, like, by the end of it, we've shifted into different little social groups within the play. And like, you know, I think it makes some sense to me. I think, you know, I think Guadagnino probably definitely wanted to honor this musician whose music has been so foundational to the show.
Yeah.
But I know what you mean. I think given the length of the concert scene, you felt a little bit like, well, we're running out of time here, guys. Like, we need to get back to our kids. But you know, what happened within that sequence, I think, satisfied emotionally what I didn't know I was looking for from the end of the show.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I like, as you're saying, like, the clock's running out. The clock's running out for these kids and our chance to spend time with them. Dawn is coming. Harper says in this episode, by this time tomorrow, I'll be so far away. You know what I mean? They're going to Chicago. They're going to Okinawa, all this sort of stuff like that. So I just felt the urgency of that time. And so a little bit of impatience with like spending the time with Dev Hynes, who's like a perfectly, like, the music's great and like was a nice, you know, presence in this episode. So it's no knock on that music or that appearance necessarily, but it's just sort of like a little off balance for me, I guess, with what I would prefer to have in my final episode.
Though maybe that's kind of the point, in that, like, you know, thinking back to like the last week before college started when I was, you know, 18, or the last week of college 4 years later, where like you're doing all this activity and it's so exciting and you're hanging out, and then one morning it's just like, oh, it's time to graduate and goodbye. You know. Yeah. and there's always an anticlimax to it. It never feels as fulfilling as it should. I mean, they got to punctuate the night with this cupping together or this kissing and whatever that implies, but then, you know, like, eventually they're not running away. They're going to have to go back. And, you know, so I think that, like, maybe the sense that we did lose them a little bit in this episode was deliberate.
Excellent. All right. Well, is there anything else you want to mention about this episode specifically or the show as a whole before we say ciao, adio?
We would say arrivederci.
Yeah,
that would be the big goodbye. You know, no, I don't think so. I mean, I think I've rambled on enough, but like, I think it was just such a lovely show and such an interesting one, a challenging one. I'm really glad we covered it. I really hope that people who have listened to this show will be evangelical about this, about We Are Who We Are to friends and families and whoever, because I haven't seen much chatter about it. I don't know, but
I think I have to wonder, I know some people were waiting for it to end so they could watch it all at once, because that is our crazed binge culture that we exist in. You know, so if people might enjoy it as like an 8-hour Luca Guadagnino experience, Luca Guadagnino plus other collaborators, obviously. And then, you know, and I also think it's sad to say, but a lot of people nowadays sort of that I know of wait to hear how something ends before they even start it. Not the specifics of it, but just sort of like, is this going to let me down the way that Game of Thrones did or whatever? Like, I don't want to get invested. And, you know, I would just say, I agree with you. I hope people are evangelical about the show. I hope you guys who are enjoying it or enjoying hearing us talk about it, go out and tell your friends that this is something that they should really, that it is a little bit of a challenge at the beginning, but I think that challenge sort of makes the sweetness, and the, emotional resonance at the end feel like really like hard won in a nice way. So,
yeah. And if you want to feel like the kids are going to be something close to all right, no matter what happens tomorrow.
Yeah.
Here's a show to watch.
By tomorrow, do you mean next Tuesday? I mean,
well, this will be airing on Monday, right?
Yep. Fair enough. All right, Richard, until whatever happens after next Tuesday, where can folks find you?
Well, I think I'm just going to be wandering through Bologna, hoping to meet my own kind of cute tour guide who wants to kiss. Who's my age, by the way.
Yeah.
And I'll be tweeting at Rylaws and writing at VF.com. And Joanna, where will you be until, I guess, well, we'll be back here talking about the other show, but for the next few weeks. But in the Italian version of you, where will that person be?
Well, absolutely not ordering Domino's pizza my last night in Italy. That's for sure. so I guess winging my way back to Chicago. Anyway, or you can find me at vanityfair.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. Please do always email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. I've loved your emails around this show. They've been really great. And, keep that going, keep that attitude going for the undoing, and we will make it through 2020 together. It'll be fine. All right. We'll see you guys next time.
Mille grazie.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.